we go. Good morning, Wednesday morning Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to do the first part of chapter 18 today. You'll remember last time we met, which was 2 weeks ago, skipping Thanksgiving last week. Last time we met, we finished up chapter 17. Chapter 17 is the high priestly prayer. Jesus prays for his apostles and his disciples, and he prays for us as well. All those who will believe because of their word. So that's praying for us. It's just an awesome prayer. Chapter 17 finishes the number of chapters where Jesus is teaching them while they're meeting on Monday, Thursday. So 14 through 17 does all this teaching. 17 concludes that. And then if you'll remember, we finished last time we met by doing the first few verses of chapter 18, because 18 is a longer chapter. So I wanted to make sure we could get through it in 2 weeks. So I'll just very briefly recap the first handful of verses of chapter 18 and then see if there's any questions and we'll go on, okay? So 18 verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. So yes, it takes a little, not too long, it's a bit of a walk across Jerusalem, down through the valley, the Kidron Valley, and up to the Garden of Gethsemane. The garden's not named here, but we know that's the Garden of Gethsemane. And of course, like many people, he had a favorite place there where he would meet with his disciples. Verse 2, now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Not unusual. The Jews, we know, wanted to arrest Jesus, but not publicly, because they were afraid of the crowds and creating a riot. So this offer of Judas to lead them in the middle of the night to a quiet place where there'd be nobody but him and his disciples, yeah, they jumped on that. So Judas was paid to be their betrayer, the betrayer of Jesus. Verse 3, so Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now, do you remember from 2 weeks ago, I talked about how I strongly disagree with the Lutheran Study Bible on this verse. The Lutheran Study Bible says Judas procured a band of Roman soldiers. I don't think it was Roman soldiers. Now, is this critical to understanding the gospel? No. But, for three reasons. First of all, the Romans didn't care at this point. This is a religious matter. That's how they viewed it. Pontius Pilate didn't even care until the chief priest started telling him, well, this man claims to be a king, so he's creating insurrection against Caesar. That's when Pilate finally had an interest in being involved. Otherwise, Pilate wasn't concerned. So why would Roman soldiers have been there? Second point is, right here it says, Judas procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees. The chief priests and the Pharisees had no authority over Roman soldiers. They did, however, have authority over whom? The temple guard. You remember me talking about this 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Okay, see, lots of heads nodding. Good. So I believe this was temple guard that Judas was given to lead. Temple guard were, they guarded the temple to keep Gentiles out of the sacred areas. So, verse 4, then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, whom do you seek? He's not running away. He sees them coming. He goes to them and meets them. Whom do you seek? Well, he knows the answer. They answered, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. Judas, who was betraying him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. This is the third reason why I think this is Jewish temple guard, not Roman soldiers. What did Jesus actually say there?
I am.
In the Greek, it's ego I me. If you remember, that's a very unusual phrase in Greek. You would not say it that way. If you were to say I am, like I am thirsty, you would say I me dipseo. Dipseo is the Greek word for thirst. So you'd say, I am thirsty, I me. By saying, ego, I me, it's very unusual. And yes, there's been multiple times we've followed this along, right? I've been bringing it out a lot. Jesus uses the Greek translation of the name Yahweh. So Jesus is basically saying he's God right here. So what happened? They drew back and fell to the ground. Now, Roman soldiers would have said, so what? They wouldn't have cared. The fact that these soldiers were taken aback, they're like, whoa, what's going on here? He's claiming to be God, the Yahweh. And they drew back and were hesitant and concerned and puzzled. That, I think, is a third piece of evidence that this is temple guard, not Roman soldiers. So while I respect the Lutheran Study Bible, I still think it's the best study Bible. And all the footnotes in it are written by seminary professors, many of which I had. Whoever wrote that note right here about Roman soldiers, I really disagree with that particular note. Sorry, I got a little chip on my shoulder there. Yeah, Joanne?
I told you I have the other study Bible from Lutheran, and mine says that he brought police from the chief priest and...
Okay.
You know, that could be the temple guard.
Yeah, that would be the temple guard, right? So that study Bible has a little more sense about them regarding this particular passage right here. So, Jesus said to them, I am he said to them, I am, and they drew back and fell to the ground. Is that about where we left off a couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments before I forge ahead?
Yeah, it was verse 6 that you left off at.
Okay, good. All right, so verse 7, he asked them again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he, so if you seek me, let these men go. So right here, you get a little sense, at least I do, I think this is kind of interesting, that they're hesitant, they're uncertain. These are Jewish guard. Jesus says, I am, ego I me. They don't know what to do. So Jesus, knowing that he has to be arrested and put on trial, he kind of coaxes them to finish doing what they need to do. That's the sense I get out of this. He asked them again, whom do you seek? You guys all backed up. You're all kind of afraid now or, you know, anxious about what's going on. Whom do you seek? He's asking them again, kind of coaxing them forward to finish arresting him. Doesn't that seem a little ironic? I think it does. And yet that's what's going on here. And then in verse 8, he says, I told you that I am he. Again, that's not I am he. Bad translation. He says, I am. I told you that I am. Ego I me. This, by the way, right here in verse 8, is the very last time in this gospel that Jesus says, ego I me. I am. The last time. He won't say it again. Okay? We pointed them out all along throughout the gospel. He said them probably... I didn't count them up. I don't know, 15, 18 times, something like that. This is the final time. And what does he say? So if you seek me, let these men go. There's a double meaning here. If you seek me, let these men go. What did all good, faithful, who thought they were faithful, Jewish people seek? Whom did they seek? Yahweh. And the Messiah to come. So Jesus is saying, you know, you guys are good Jews. You seek me. I'm the Messiah. So let these guys go. They're not Messiah, which is true. So not only is Jesus on the one hand coaxing them forward to finish arresting him, but he's also making a statement about who they seek. They seek himself. And appropriately so. That was right. But they're blind to that fact, that there it is, there's the Messiah standing right there in front of them. Verse 9, this was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, of those whom you gave me, I have lost no one. Now, of course, there was one he lost. Who was that one?
Judas,
right. So I looked up, where is this fulfilled, or where was this coming from? This came from the high priestly prayer. So just earlier this night, this is not... The verse 9 here about to fulfill the word he had spoken, this is not a reference to any Old Testament prophecy. This is a reference to Jesus' own high priestly prayer. In the middle of the high priestly prayer, he prays to God, I have lost none that you have given me save the betrayer. I forgot how he phrases it. So Jesus acknowledges earlier this same night that he's only lost one of his followers. So it's kind of interesting that Jesus fulfills his own prophecy, his own statements, later that same night, right here. And he does. So if you seek me, if you seek the Messiah, you're looking at him, but if you seek me, Jesus of Nazareth, because your bosses told you to arrest me, I'm right here, let all these men go. And we know that they fled, for the most part. Not quite all of them yet, because what happens next? Verse 10 and 11. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? So Simon Peter, we know him, right? Bit brash.
Yeah.
A bit maybe foolhardy.
Yes.
Bold and aggressive.
Yeah.
That was a good notification. Yeah, that timing was just right, huh? Yeah. All right, so we know Simon Peter and his characteristics. Having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant. Now, this is interesting. I found this in the commentary, so I followed up and looked at it a little bit. The word sword here maybe is not quite completely correct. There are two words for sword that they used in the Bible in the Greek. And one word for sword meant a long sword or a broad sword. It is what a soldier would carry. Think of the Knights of the Round Table, a long sword that's, you know, 2.5-3 feet long. Why would soldiers have a long sword? For farther reach. You could strike your enemy before he gets to you. The word here is a short sword. It was a sword that was maybe about this long with a handle on it, so maybe a foot long. You could call it more appropriately probably a dagger. Okay? And here's the interesting thing that I discovered when reading about this. This particular sword was a short sword, or a dagger if we wanted to say it in English, was particularly notable for a few different reasons. First of all, because it was shorter, it could be easily hidden in somebody's cloak. Under Jewish law, you were not allowed to bring weapons into the feasts. Passover, Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks. Oh, that's Pentecost. Feast of Tabernacles. You're not allowed to bring weapons in there. So what does this say about Peter having a weapon hidden in his cloak? Okay. He was concerned, obviously, about potential for violence, which he was justified in that, but nevertheless, he was breaking Jewish law here. So he's got this hidden in his cloak somewhere. That's the first thing. This was a dagger that was often used by assassins or those who were trying to stir up trouble. Secondly, because it's a short sword or a dagger, it is the name for the knife or the implement that was used to slaughter animals. If you're butchering an animal, you're not going to use a long sword. You need something short that you can cut the meat with and skin the animal and gut it and all of that. So this is used for slaughtering animals, and this is the name for the same sword or knife, long knife, that was used for sacrifices in the temple. A little interesting there, huh? So that's what this sword is. So, you know, it might have been better had they said having a dagger rather than a sword, but the translators put sword. He drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. So he's probably waving it around, and there's a little bit of bedlam and chaos going on. And maybe Peter is swinging his sword, his dagger, and the high priest's servant kind of maybe tries to glance away, and he gets a glancing blow along the side of his head, and it cuts his ear off. That's how I kind of pictured what would have happened, right? Now, what we don't hear here is that Jesus healed him. But we know that from other Gospels, right? Jesus likely picked up the ear and put it right back on and instantly healed him. That's amazing. What did Jesus just declare he is? Yahweh. God. And now here, moments later, in the midst of this moment of chaos, he proves he's God. Isn't that incredible? incredible right there? How would Malchus have felt? Stunned, no doubt. Painful, maybe. But also saying, what are we doing here? We've been sent to arrest this guy, and look at this. He heals my ear that got cut off. This is incredible. You know, I'm sure that Malchus was completely flustered by the whole thing, not knowing what to think. Now, we only get his name here, Malchus. In the other Gospels, it just says the high priest's servant. So probably what happened, the high priest is like, I'm not going with this crowd. There could be violence. But you, my trusted servant, go follow the temple guard and this Judas who's leading them, and you be my eyes and ears. I want a report of what goes on. So that's probably why Malchus is there, the high priest's servant, to watch what's going on and see the proceedings. And here, and we get these details here in the Gospel of John. Cut off his right ear, and that his name is Malchus. Why would John give us those details? Yeah, Debbie.
They're historical.
Yes, they're historical. Remember when John was written?
Later.
Later is the last of the Gospels. John already knows the other Gospels have been written. This is, I forgot what we had said at the very, very beginning of the Bible study. 70, 80 AD, something like that. Is Malchus still around? Probably, we don't know. Is Malchus a follower of Jesus? Probably, but we don't know. Okay, we don't know. There's no early church indication. But at a minimum, he'd still be around. Could somebody go and find Malchus and ask him, hey, is this how it happened, like he says here? And Malchus would say, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. You want to see the scars from where he stitched me up? You know, obviously there'd be no scars. Jesus' healings are perfect. But he would have said, yeah, it was my right ear. That's exactly what happened. We get these details here, historical details from John, which helps to give authenticity to the entire gospel. This has happened periodically throughout the gospel where we get significant, specific details which shows that this is true and genuine. Okay? Ellen?
Makes you wonder whether there might have been other people there that night that thought, oh boy, this is, I don't want to be part of this, but they didn't dare, you know, say that.
I would have no doubt. You know, the first round of Christians were all Jewish from Jerusalem. So could some of this band of temple guard, after Jesus rose from the dead, knowing what happened here on this night and seeing what happened, could they have converted to Christianity? Likely. I mean, we don't know. But yeah, it's very likely that some of them became followers of Jesus. All right, so Jesus said to Peter, put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? The word sword there is the same one previously, so you could think of it as dagger or a long knife. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? What does that make you think of?
Last Supper.
Last Supper? Somebody last night said that too. And that's not where I'm going, but that is an interesting thought, that Jesus took the cup and blessed it and gave it to them. And here he says, shall I not drink the cup? Is there a connection between this and the Last Supper? Yeah, probably. I hadn't thought about that. So yes, that's a good thought.
He also said in the garden, I still have to drink this cup.
There you go. Is that what you're going to say, Mark?
Get thee behind me, Satan.
Oh, yeah, get thee behind me, Satan, sure. What's missing in this account in John is Jesus praying in the garden.
Oh, okay.
That's not here, is it?
No, it's not.
Why not? Well, it's already in the other three Gospels. John knows the other three Gospels have already been written. This is the fourth of them. A lot of the stories and details and miracles and teaching of Jesus in the Gospel of John are not in the other three. The other three are very similar, right? We call them the synoptics. John is different. So here too, he doesn't give the account of Jesus praying, Lord, Father, if it be your will, take this cup from me, but not my will, yours be done. Somewhere prior to this event, and after they arrived in the garden, Jesus prayed. Remember, he went off by himself to pray, and prayed three times, and the disciples kept falling asleep. And he kept praying, take this cup from me. What cup? the cup of suffering, the cup of wrath upon sin. Take this cup from me, but not my will, yours be done. And now here, a short time after that, whatever it is, half an hour, hour, they come to arrest him, and Jesus says, shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? How quick did Jesus get his answer to that prayer? Pretty quick. He sees Judas and the temple guard approaching. He knows the answer to his prayer from just a little bit ago, that yes, he has to drink this cup. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Put your sword into its sheath. All right. Questions or comments? That's the end of that paragraph. Yeah, Joanne.
When they say they're looking for Jesus of Nazareth, and he replies, I am, and they step back and fall to the ground.
Yeah.
I was always under the impression that it was the power of the I am that knocked them down.
That might have been part of it. That could have been.
And so I would have thought right then those people would have thought, oh my goodness, what has happened here?
Yeah, absolutely. What is going on here? Our leaders are the chief priests. They sent us to arrest this guy. And look at him. He claims to be the Messiah. He claims to be God. Why are we arresting him? Oh, they were completely taken aback. Yes. And some of it is the power of what Jesus said. Yes, absolutely. All right. Okay, going on then. Verses 12, 13, and 14. Short paragraph here. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Now I find this to be an interesting verse because like so much of the Gospel of John, there's double meanings, hidden meanings in here. So first of all, they arrested Jesus and bound him. On the surface, that's a simple statement of fact. What happened? They grabbed a hold of him and bound him probably with ropes. Although if you've seen the Passion of the Christ, who's seen the Passion of the Christ? Well, not that many of you, maybe half. Well, we could show it again if you ever want to see it. It's very graphic and very emotional. Well, they depict this in the Passion of the Christ because Jesus says, I am, and they all kind of retreat a few steps. They're all puzzled. And then, whom do you see? Jesus of Nazareth. I told you I am. Let these men go. Then you can see in the movie, they kind of depict it, that they kind of very hesitantly surround Jesus. And then all at once, they all jump and grab him. I think that's probably a good image of what might have happened. Because they're hesitant, they don't know, and this Jesus, he can do miracles, he just healed that guy's ear. So they jump on him simultaneously, and in the movie they wrap him with chains, but in reality I think it would have been ropes. Chains were too expensive. Metal. Alright, but that's the surface meaning here. What's the secondary, deeper meaning here? This is how I see it, a little insight into the mind of a pastor. Yeah? And?
So he's being prepared for sacrifice. So he's being bound.
Yeah.
And being put on the altar for sacrifice.
Well, that is a very interesting thought. That's not what I was thinking. But yes, he's being bound as a sacrifice. Very good.
Yeah, Debbie? The man goes on complaining for
him. He goes on complaining.
He needed no bounds from him.
That's right. Absolutely true, too. The lambs are silent before they're slaughtered, and here Jesus is silent, too. Another good point. I hadn't thought of these.
He's surrendering his power to the crowd.
He is surrendering his power. He's submitting to them.
By
allowing himself to be bound. Another good point. Wow! See, this is why I like teaching, because I learn. No, my mind as a preacher, if I ever preached on this verse, which I don't think this particular paragraph comes up in our lectionary, if I preached on this, this is how I would address this, a deeper meaning. So the soldiers and the captain and the officers are seeking God. They're seeking Yahweh. Jesus says, I am Yahweh, let these men go. And then what do? They bind Yahweh. How often do we do that in our lives? Well, God, I know you're there, but I want to go my own way. I want to do my own thing right now. God, I know you're there, but, you know, this is my pet sin. I really like to indulge myself in this little pet sin that I do. So you know what, God? I'm going to bind you and put you over there in the corner. You stay away from me until I need you. Does that sound familiar? I think all of us do that. We bind God and put him in a corner until we feel we need him. Because otherwise, we want to do what we want to do in our lives. Okay? That's how I would preach this. Debbie?
Also, the church throughout history has at times bound Jesus.
Yeah, right.
Rules and regulations.
Yes, right. Putting all kinds of regulations on. Right. Jill?
You know, I'm thinking about them binding him and how he broke the I guess you could say, like, broke the bonds of the tomb.
Right.
Like, just a few days later. So they've got these pinly human ropes that they're holding him with, and he's allowing them because he could have, you know.
Oh, absolutely he could have.
He could have.
Yeah. He could have done a Hulk maneuver. Busted him apart. Yeah, Hulk smash, yeah. Right. No, yeah, he allowed it to happen. All right, verse 13 and 14. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. So first they took him to Annas. Now if you hear a little bit about history, or it might be in the study Bible or commentaries, Annas was the high priest at one point. Some, I don't know, a couple of decades maybe, prior to this point.
It says 6 AD to 15.
Okay, so that would be about 15 years prior to this. Annas was the high priest. Now what happened during this time, this era of in biblical history, is that the political forces, be it Herod or be it the Roman government through Pilate, had veto power over the high priest. So they could dictate who was high priest. Is that how God wanted it? No. God had said, who was the first high priest? Aaron. And then the high priest was to be passed down to son to son to son. The Levites supported the high priest. They were priests. But the high priest was from the line of Aaron. That was on purpose and how God defined it. So here at this era of time, political forces are controlling who is high priest. This is not according to God's will. Annas got himself into trouble or on the outs with the political forces, so they deposed him, and then Annas' son and son-in-laws became high priests in succession after him. Again, this is not following God's regulations in the Old Testament. And yet the Jews are kind of forced into it because the political forces have military power. Okay? So that's a little bit of the conundrum that's going on here in the high priesthood. So who really is in control? Who's really the true high priest? Caiaphas is high priest in name. But where do they take Jesus first? Annas. Who's really the one in authority? Annas, it appears, right? He's the one you go to first. So he's pulling the strings behind the scene. Very strange, and it shows you a little bit of the intrigue and the mystery that's going on within the Jewish hierarchy at this time, okay? So that's what's going on here. And then verse 14, again, it's a double entendre. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. I think it was back in chapter 11 when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, and the Jewish leaders got all upset because this Jesus is going to ruin everything. He's going to change everything, and he's going to get the Romans mad at us. And back there in chapter 11, Caiaphas said, "You don't understand. It's better that one man should die than the whole nation." You remember that? Well, here is just a callback to that statement from some number of chapters ago. And Caiaphas, on the surface, is in fact saying, "Well, we should make sure that this Jesus dies, is executed, so that the rest of us don't get punished by the Romans." But in truth, what's the double meaning here in the eyes of God is what? Caiaphas spoke the truth. Better that Jesus die than all humanity be condemned to hell. Right? Oh, what wonderful, delicious double meanings here. I just love it. I just love it. All right. Let me pause a minute. Questions? Comments? Yeah, Ellen?
I loved it. They know that God is using them.
Yeah. Had they known that God was using them, yes. Any other comments? You guys need more coffee?
Just got some.
Do you have a question about it?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's forge ahead. How are we on time? Whoa, we're okay. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. So who is that other disciple?
John.
How did John refer to himself in his own gospel?
The other disciple.
The other disciple, or often the disciple whom Jesus loved. And the sense of that, remember I talked about this, is that the disciple whom even this disciple that Jesus loved, like it's, of course Jesus loved everybody, but even me he loved. John never names himself in his gospel. So it comes across, I think, as a little bit of humility on his part. So that's good. So this is Simon Peter and John following. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest, but Peter stood outside at the door. So let me paint a picture for you. The way that structures were, housing places back at that time, you'd have a street in the middle of that's going through the city, and there'd be a wall there, and there'd be an opening in the wall that if you would go in, you'd have a courtyard. It'd be an open-air courtyard. We would probably call it an atrium today. And the richer you were, the bigger it would be. If you were poor or maybe middle class, you might not have a courtyard. But in your place of residence, you would have an open-air courtyard, and that's where you would have a fire, also for cooking. And then around that, you would have rooms. Again, the richer you were, the more rooms you'd have and the bigger they would be. And there'd be a room maybe where you'd eat or prepare food. You could cook it on the fire here. You'd have other rooms where you'd be sleeping. You might have a gathering room where you'd gather together with family, etc. So that is kind of the lay of the land. Now Annas, being a high priest, or being the ex-high priest, although this is curious right here, since that disciple was known to the high priest, John doesn't call him the ex-high priest, the former high priest, he calls him the high priest. Again, who's in control here? So John is known to the high priest, and he entered with Jesus into the courtyard. Peter stood outside at the door. There's a servant girl there just kind of keeping watch over the door and only letting in those who are known to the high priest. Now this does beg the question, for which we have no answer, why is it John was known by the high priest? We have no idea. We can speculate. Maybe at some point John had worked for him or someone in the household. Maybe John grew up with one of the servants in the household. So they were friends with each other. We really have no idea. In some manner, John was known by someone in the high priest's household. So he went in with Jesus, but Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest, so that's John, he was known, he's inside in the courtyard, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. He goes up to her and says, I know this guy, he's with me, you can let him in. Okay, so then Peter goes in. Kind of reminds me, there would have been other people there, by the way, probably wanting to get in to see what's going on. Kind of reminds me, if some of you can picture this, maybe you've experienced it or maybe you've seen it in movies. In my days after college or maybe during college, before marriage, and you would go clubbing. Anybody do that? No, I didn't do that very much. That was a very short period of time in my life. But I do remember a few times we'd go clubbing, a college buddy or whatever, we'd say, hey, let's go down to the club. We'll get a couple of drinks and dance, see what kind of music. Or they got a band that's playing. We really like that band. Or, you know, he might have said something like, let's see if there's any pretty girls there. So there you are, 10 o'clock at night. this, again, this only happened to me a couple of times. I'm not trying to paint a picture of your pastor. This is not my normal scene.
Until he met you.
You're standing in line, yeah, right. You're standing in line there trying to get into this club, and somebody walks up and somebody else comes out, says to the bouncer at the door, "Oh, I know that person. They can come in and they get ushered right in. What about us? We're standing here waiting in line. That guy gets cuts just because he knows somebody?" Yeah. That's how it happens, right?
Yeah.
And we didn't know anybody, so there we stand waiting to get in. And I remember it was cold and we were in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
All right. So Peter gets brought in. He cuts the line, and if there was a line, there wouldn't have been a line, but there might have been a small crowd there trying to figure out what's going on. So Peter gets brought in. Verse 17. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" Now that's a little clunky. Mm-hmm. I actually looked it up in the Greek, and I kind of did my own personal translation. This is how I think it would be best translated. You're not one of this man's disciples? It's asked in the negative sense. So that is true, and that does come through in this kind of clunky translation here. You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? I think a better sense of this is, you're not one of this man's disciples? She's asking it like that. Now if you think about this for a minute, they have taken Jesus probably into one of the further rooms where Annas and maybe some other high priests and Pharisees are now starting to talk to Jesus and interrogate him. Right outside that room, there likely was no doors, just an opening. There are the temple guards standing there milling about with a few non-guard among them. John and Peter are standing there. Is this a tense situation? Would you be scared?
So, yeah.
Absolutely, you would be scared. And so when somebody asks you a question about, are you associated with that guy that just got arrested and brought in? And they ask it in a negative question, what's the easiest thing to come out of your mouth? No. Are you what? You're not one of this guy's disciples? That's how the question, I think, should be phrased or translated. And what does he say? I am not. And by the way, looking that up too, he says, I me, not. I me, may. May is the negative in the Greek. So he says, I me, may. He doesn't say, ego, I me. That's an awkward phrase, and he wouldn't have been using it. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Now I looked this up. Charcoal, because I'm unfamiliar with that word in the Greek, and I looked it up, and that's not actually the Greek word there. This is interesting. I don't know how this is connected. The Greek word there is anthrax.
Anthrax?
Yeah, I don't know. But I look up anthrax in my Greek dictionary, and what it says is burning coals or embers.
Well, isn't there anthrax and bituminite or something like that? Two different kinds of?
I guess. It must be related somehow. Anthracite. What?
Anthracite.
That's
hard coal.
Hard coal, okay. So maybe that word, anthracite, is related to this word here, anthrax. And yes, in my Greek dictionary it says burning coals or embers. So it does have the sense of a charcoal fire, okay? Although this isn't really a perfect translation. But it made me think it was cold. Now this is springtime of the year. There have been some of you who have been to Holy Land, right? Israel? A few of you? I don't remember who in here has been. Well, Jill and I have been. We were there in January, twice. And even in January, the night temperatures get down to, what, into the 40s? And during the day, it was generally like in the 60s. So being from Michigan in January, we're like, oh, this is nice spring weather, you know, just wear a jacket or a sweatshirt, you're fine. But it does get down to 40, so it's a little bit chilly. While we were there, there's a couple of times our guide had on a parka, with the fur-lined hood pulled up, and it's all, he's all tucked in, and he's talking to us and explaining stuff, but he was cold. And we're like, oh, this is glorious weather. Now, I'm sure the opposite is true in July when it's 95 degrees, and he's like, oh, this is wonderful. And we're like, I'm melting. They don't get snow up, except up in the mountains, but it's still got cold. Okay? So they have a charcoal fire or burning embers or anthracite, if you will, whatever that is. I don't know. It was cold, and they're standing there warming themselves, and Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Yeah, they're trying to stay warm. And probably also Peter and John are trying to eavesdrop on what's going on with Annas interrogating Jesus. So they're eavesdropping. It wouldn't have been, you know, particularly improper. All the guards are there. They're all kind of waiting to see what happens. Verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Oh my goodness. If you're Peter and John standing around a fire warming yourself, surrounded by soldiers, temple guard, and you hear the high priest question your teacher, your master, about you. If I'm standing there, put yourself in that situation, I think my face would have just drained of all its blood. I would have turned white. I'm like, oh my goodness, why am I even here? If they find out that I'm one of his, I'll be arrested along with him. You're going to be just white with fear, I would think. If you're in that situation, wouldn't you be? Jesus answered them, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. Jesus doesn't answer about his disciples. He doesn't answer about his teaching. As often happens, what does Jesus do? He's a little bit oblique, isn't he? Now, part of this is Jesus knows whatever he says, will they believe him?
No.
No. Doesn't matter what he says. Truth or false, they won't believe him. They're all already skewed against him. So what does he say? Go find some witnesses. By the way, there's a little hint here. Where are the witnesses? This is not a legal trial. There are no witnesses. And according to Jewish law, that was true. You had to have how many witnesses?
Two or three
witnesses to accuse somebody. That was on purpose, and that was Jewish law. There's no witnesses. And Jesus' answer is, in his head, he's thinking, you're not going to believe whatever I say. So, you know what? I've spoken openly. I'm not hidden anything. Go find some witnesses from a synagogue or a temple, and ask them what I taught and what I said. So that's his plain answer. There's nothing hidden there.
And it looks and sounds like to me that they're breaking their own law.
They are breaking their own law. And here's another thing that doesn't come up right here, but what time of the day or night is this?
This is night.
This is the middle of the night. You know, this is probably somewhere around 2, 3 in the morning at this point. Jewish law, all trials had to take place during daylight. Why? For transparency and openness, so that it's legitimate and above board. So this is an illegal trial for multiple reasons. Where are the witnesses? And it's taking place at night. All right. So Jesus gives them kind of an oblique answer here, kind of skirting the direct answer, but he speaks openly. He says, well, you know, go ask the witnesses. I would have to admit, hearing that answer, if you just read it out, it does sound a little bit belligerent. Doesn't it? A little bit insolent. Jesus is being a little bit, just a touch of attitude here, maybe. Maybe? I don't know. Well, they must have felt that way too, because verse 22, when he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? So, because it says struck him with his hand, it must have been a slap. Again, there's something that's against proceedings. Back then, as today, a defendant was afforded protection from harm until convicted. So that was wrong of that soldier to slap Jesus. Frankly, again, back to the movie, The Passion of the Christ, when they arrested Jesus, they beat him and punched him, and we know elsewhere from the other Gospels, they pulled out his beard and spit on him. So he was not given the protections that should have been afforded him as a defendant. Another reason, this is an illegal trial. Okay? So I hope you get that sense going on here. Is that how you answer the high priest after he struck Jesus? Verse 23, Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Jesus is saying, if I said something that's improper, then tell me. But otherwise, why'd you hit me? I almost get the sense when Jesus says, "Where are the witnesses?" He's kind of goading them again, just like when they tried to arrest him and they fell back and he kind of had to ask them again, coax them. "Who are you seeking? I'm right here." Here also he's saying, "Go get the witnesses so that this is a legitimate trial." He's kind of poking them towards doing the right procedure for this trial. That's kind of the sense I get here. All right. Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong, but if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Yeah, he did maybe have a little bit of belligerence in his answer there. Verse 24, Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Well, who's the high priest? There's only one. Annas is referred to as the high priest. Caiaphas is referred to as the high priest. So again, there's some of that intrigue of what's going on in the upper echelons of Jewish authority. It's kind of messed up.
Yes. So are the past high priest always referred to as a high priest, like our presidents? You know, we'll still say president.
Well, I guess we will. I generally would say ex-president. But yeah, a lot of people would still say president. President Bush, President Trump, President Obama, etc. So I guess maybe that's part of what's going on here. Yeah, that's a possibility. You're right. It's still curious why they took him first to Annas.
Yeah.
Right. Rather than to Caiaphas. Yeah. All right. Other questions, comments so far? Or are we on time? Just over an hour, but remember we started with announcements and prayers and song and all that. Okay. I've got one more short paragraph here, and that's where I finished last night. Okay? So one more little bit here. Three more verses. Verse 25, now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, "You also are not one of his disciples, are you?" Actually, that's the same phrase, the same question that was asked by the servant girl at the door. You're not one of his disciples? That's the tone or the way that I would say is a better translation. You're not one of his disciples? So it's asked in the negative sense, where all he has to do is say no. And he's answering the question. He denied it and said, "I am not." Again, it's not ego I me, it's just I me. I me me is what he says. I am not. One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Oh my goodness. Now notice, it doesn't appear like any of these are the guard directly asking him. And yet Peter is still afraid. Peter is still afraid. And of course, in that situation, think about it, they've already abused Jesus. All those present know this is an illegal trial. And it doesn't look good for Jesus right now. And so they're asking Peter, "Aren't you one of his disciples? You're not one of his disciples?" "No, I'm not." And in this case, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off. So already, the miracle that Jesus did with Malchus has already spread through the household and other people. They already know about it. Again, that leads you to a little bit of this maybe conflicted nature, especially among the guard or among the household or the servants. You know, our leaders they got it out for this guy. They're setting him up for a false trial. They're going to convict him. And yet look what he did. We know Malchus. Malchus is here among us. His ear was cut off and it was healed. So they're kind of perplexed, many of them. And so this relative of a man whose ear Peter cut off, did I not see you in the crowd, in the garden with him? Again, Peter denied it, and at once, a rooster crowed. Now, I never grew up on the farm, nor have I ever lived next to a farm. Do roosters only crow at sunrise?
No.
No.
But that's primarily when they crow?
No,
not necessarily? All right, that's when they start? Can a rooster crow? Does a rooster generally crow in the middle of the night when it's still dark?
About
4
o'clock in the morning in Hawaii.
4 o'clock in the morning in Hawaii. My impression is, not being a farmer, that the rooster crowing means that it's daybreak, that the sun is starting to rise. Mm-hmm. So it's like 5:30, 6 o'clock there this time of year. So this trial has been going on all night. Now, I don't know if that's true, if a rooster would crow prior to daybreak or not. That could... I'm not sure. I can tell you a funny little story. I don't think she would mind. I did not get her permission. Many of you know Christy, our church secretary right now.
Yes.
They live down in Buchanan. They have some land. They have lots of pets. They have rabbits, and they have ducks, and they have chickens. And a number of months ago, Christy came in saying, that rooster started crowing at sunrise and wouldn't stop crowing. I was going to go out there and wring his neck. And I have heard some of you talk about that, about, yep, that rooster, that's the first choice for chicken dinner next Sunday. Right. So, now, what's not here are some of those details we know from the other Gospels. Jesus actually says in Luke, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. So there's a little detail that's not here. Does that mean that the Gospels are inconsistent or that they disagree with each other? No. John here does not say the rooster only crowed once. He says at once a rooster crowed. It could have crowed immediately a second time, and John just didn't put it down. So don't let those types of details lead you into believing somebody that says, well, the Bible's inconsistent, it's filled with errors. No, it's not. It's just not mentioned. That's all. Secondly, and kind of the last thing I want to leave here as well with is, Peter denies it the third time, and at once the rooster crowed. And if you look at the next verse here in John, where we'll pick up, they led him to Caiaphas' house. To the governor's headquarters. So that goes on with the story. That's where we'll pick up next week. But we know from the other Gospels, when the rooster crowed, what did Jesus do? Looked at him. Looked at Peter. Now remember, if Jesus is surrounded by some of the priests and the Sadducees, Pharisees, he's in this room, there's an open doorway, and there is the courtyard, and there's a charcoal fire or anthracite, is that what it is? Anthracite fire there, and they're warming themselves. Can Jesus hear the rooster crow out there? Sure. And can he look through the door and catch Peter's eye? Absolutely. And what did Peter do?
Goes out and cried.
Went out and
wept bitterly.
Wept bitterly. I love that translation. He wasn't just having a few tears dribble down his cheek. He wept bitterly. He immediately knew what he had done, and he regretted it. There's the difference between Peter and Judas, right? You see it. And to me, this is an exact illustration for us about, all of you know, like a toddler, you catch a toddler, or say an early elementary school kid doing something wrong, you catch them doing something wrong. And they see you catch them doing something wrong. And all you have to do is look at them or say something. Jimmy? And you're going to get one of two answers. Two responses. I didn't do it. Wasn't my fault. I don't care that you just saw me do it. I didn't do it. They get obstinate and resistant, right? Or the other common response from, say, a four-year-old or a six-year-old is they're just crushed. They realize they've been caught, and they just break down crying, I'm sorry, Mommy, I'm sorry, Daddy, please don't punish me, I don't want to have time out, or whatever, right? Here you see that from Judas and Peter. Judas is obstinate. Peter breaks down and wept bitterly. He was sorry for what he did. Okay? Now that's not recorded here, doesn't need to be recorded here because it's in the other Gospels. So John kind of skips some of the details that he knows people have already heard from the other Gospels. So that's really, that's the only thought about why some of these details are different. Okay, that brings us to where I want to stop. Comments or questions? Arlene?
When Caiaphas said it is best for one to die, what did he mean?
Well, what he meant by that was that if we let Jesus go on, he's going to stir up trouble for us Jews with the Romans, and the Romans are going to crack down on us and kill a whole bunch of Jews or arrest us or prevent us from doing what we want. So the whole nation of Jews are going to be affected if this one false Messiah stirs up trouble. So it's better that he would die, and we can put away that trouble and still be on good status with the Romans. So that's what he meant. Of course, the truth of it, the double meaning is, yes, it's better for Jesus to die than all of us to die. Yeah. Joanne.
In verse number 26 there, where it says, one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man who had been Malchus, whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden? So he was there too.
Yes. So there was more than one servant of the high priest there. There must have been at least two, maybe some more,
high priests. With his witnessing, he had to tell people, well, you should see what happened to my brother.
Yeah, right.
His cousin or whoever.
Right. His ear was cut off, and this Jesus healed it on the spot. And right prior to that, he said, Ego me, Yahweh. So, yes, there. Like I said, I think in the lower echelons, the soldiers and the servants, they're all in turmoil. They're like, what is going on here? This guy might be telling the truth. Why are our leaders, the priests and the Pharisees, why are they persecuting this guy with an illegal trial, no less? They're setting him up. So I think that, underneath, yes, there's some knowledge that things aren't right. All right, other questions or comments? Dean?
In verse 25, and also when the servant girl says it, it says, you also are not one of these. What does that also mean? Does that mean, like, you don't think John was one of his disciples? Or?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I go back to, I think that that's a clunky translation anyway. So I looked it up and did my own personal little translation of that phrase. And what did I say I came up with? You're not one of this man's disciples? I don't know that the word also is in there. So that's part of the problem with translations is that a translation comes out and the translators copyright it. So that means another translation comes out, like the ESV, and they cannot use maybe the phrase for the translation that they want to use because it's already been copyrighted by the NASB or the NIV. So they have to come up with an alternate translation, and sometimes you end up with these clunky translations, and the ESV translators would say, yeah, we know that's not the best, but we had to use it because this other phrase was already taken by the NIV. Part of the problem with modern day legalities of translations, okay? That's why it's good for us to be able to go back to the Greek. All right. Other questions or comments? All right, very good. Well, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.